ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. I'm very pleased to let you know that tomorrow is open day, so if you're in Canberra tomorrow, please come along and have a look behind the scenes at some of the things that happen in this building. And because it's Floriade as well, you can also book tours of the courtyard gardens. So if you're here, come and visit us tomorrow. But today, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Andrew Hudson, who's a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning at the University of Melbourne. He's had a long association with Parliament House, and in particular, he's looked closely at the competition to design this Parliament House. The competition was won by Aldo Jurgula, and this is what we ended up with. But Andrew's going to talk to us today about some of the other options we could have had and some of the stories. So please welcome Andrew Hudson.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to come and speak at your occasional lecture series. I hope it's worthwhile. Okay, is that better? Okay, I'll get closer. I won't repeat the last bit. I was just thanking everyone for the opportunity and the Senate for the opportunity and the invitation to speak today. I've entitled the lecture today, A Square Peg in a Square Hole. Now, notice on the flyer it had a question mark after it. Since I sent the title out for the flyer, I've chopped the question mark off. And hopefully it'll make a bit more sense. Now, it is an analogy. It's not an indication of the physical construction of Parliament House in the circle of Capitol Hill, so don't take it too literally, because I do notice that there are lots of circles and squares on the top of Capitol Hill with new Parliament House. What I'll be talking about today will be a review of the 1979 architectural competition for the new and what was then called the permanent Parliament House. And hopefully have the opportunity to sort of show some of examples of competition entries that you haven't seen. Presumably you haven't seen very many of them because, by my reckoning, out of the 300-odd competition entries, only 20 of them have been published. So that leaves 300-odd, which aren't very well known at all. The presentation today will be roughly in two parts. The first part will be looking at the history of the signing of Parliament House, and to give some insights into the political context for the competition and some of the political sensitivities which the competition organisers and the competition entrants had to respond to. And I'll be looking at how those entries have responded to the competition criteria, and also we'll finish on speculations as to why the Mitchell Jurgula Thorpe entry, which is we're sitting in its manifestation at the moment, why that was selected as the ultimate winner. First, regarding the site, you probably recognise this particular plan. This is the consolidated plan of the Griffins competition-winning entry for Canberra, the planning of Canberra. Now, before people get up in arms about my misuse of the apostrophe after Griffin's there, I'll just quickly say that Walter Burley Griffin and his wife Marion Mahoney Griffin together planned the competition and worked on its planning subsequent to winning the competition, so I put the apostrophe after the Griffins because it belongs to both of them. Capitol Hill, as we can see here, where we're sitting roughly there, I think. Capitol Hill, as you can note from this particular plan, is, as far as the planning of Canberra is concerned, the central focus of the overall urban design. As you can see, the radial streets and boulevards all end up in this particular point. So it's an apex of the plan. And so by that right, it is probably one of the most important sites in Australia. Griffins recognised this and decided that it was a place which is appropriate not for Parliament House. Parliament House is an arm of legislation and government, and the apex of the capital of the nation shouldn't necessarily house that legislative function. So they located Parliament House here in their plan on what's called Camp Hill. Camp Hill no longer exists. It was being bulldozed by the land bridge, which connect old Parliament House to new. On top of Capitol Hill, the Griffins envisaged what they called a Capitol building as part of their competition entry. The use for top of Capitol Hill changed in the years after they won the competition in terms of promoting either a small casino, which is a public facility, not a gambling facility, or National Archives, or some sort of national building which was a public symbol rather than a symbol of government. I just ask you to note here that the ziggureted roof on the Capitol building, and that may spark some interest later in the lecture, I hope. As we can see, Provisional Parliament House is here. It was called Provisional Parliament House because in 1923, when it was planned to build Provisional Parliament House, it was intended only as a stopgap measure for housing of government until the permanent Parliament House could be constructed. Even in 1923, they recognised that by building it here, which is just in front of what was Camp Hill, they'd be compromising the potential site for the permanent Parliament House. And even then they realised that even though it was called provisional, it wasn't a temporary building and it would remain permanently in location. And the longer it remained in location, the more difficult it would be to have it removed to accommodate something immediately behind it. Sorry about the quality of the slide, but that's Camp Hill here, immediately behind it, and there's Capitol Hill up there. So as you can see, the provision of what might happen behind here is going to be severely impacted by the location of the Provisional Parliament House. In 1958, or 1957 was the commissioning, but in 1958, Sir William Holford delivered a report on the plan of Canberra. Yeah, this report was commissioned by the Prime Minister at the time, Sir Robert Menzies, who wanted him to sort of sort out some of the issues of Canberra and get it moving again because it had stalled in the post-war period in terms of its development. He suggested and proposed that Parliament House, the new permanent Parliament House, would be located here on the lakeside. There's Provisional Parliament House here. He accommodated the fact that Burley Griffin's, or the Griffin's plan for Canberra, had envisaged a land axis, which is the main axis we see between Capitol Hill and Mount Ainslie, which would come across through here. And so whatever was located here would have to be split in half somehow to allow the visual land axis to sort of continue through. He also proposed these things called royal pavilions on Capitol Hill, which we thought would be a nice set of apartments for the visiting monarch of Great Britain and Australia when they deigned to visit. Implication being if they had their own pavilions, they'd be more likely to visit more frequently. Even Robert Menzies, who was a self-confessed Anglophile, thought this is probably going a bit beyond the pale and never published this particular plan, but published an alternative plan which had national archives or national buildings shown up here, not the royal pavilions. So where to site Permanent Parliament House? As you can see, there was some controversy regarding where it should go and some complications regarding the Provisional Parliament House, sort of confusing the original intended location. Now, I'll just read through a few notes here about the sequence of events which led up to the final location for Permanent Parliament House. In 1968, there was a motion put to Parliament which would confirm the lakeside site. This notion of the lakeside site was supported by the leaders of both sides of Parliament at the time, and it was put to a free vote of the parliamentary members. They defeated that vote and thought that it wasn't a very good idea at all. And so it had to go back to what was the recently formed NCDC, the National Capital Development Commission, and they had to look at other sites. And they returned to the Camp Hill site. And this is a hypothetical construction of what Parliament might look like on the rear of the Provisional Parliament House on the Camp Hill site, which is here. Still having to deal with the same problem of the land axis, sort of wanting to go through the building, so again splitting the two parts of the building up to allow sort of visual gap between there, leading up to Capitol Hill. The Camp Hill site had some preference by the NCDC, and in 1969 the vote was again put to Parliament for the Camp Hill site, and that again was rejected by the parliamentarians. Prime Minister Gordon had had enough of this at this particular time and overrode the decision and confirmed that the lakeside site would be the site for Permanent Parliament House. A change of government in 1972 and a change of the commissioner for the NCDC led to another vote in Parliament regarding the site, and as before, a combined vote in 1974 of both houses led a majority of parliamentarians to select Capitol Hill as a site that they wanted for their permanent Parliament House. And everyone had had enough by then, and they decided that they were going to stick with that particular location, and it was passed through an Act of Parliament that Capitol Hill would be the site for the new Parliament House. It's worth speculating in why there was this sort of runaround regarding the site. It's partly to do with the fact that Capitol Hill, as I mentioned before, was the most prominent location in Canberra and arguably one of the most prominent locations in the nation. And the leaders of the political parties could see some difficulties in trying to convince the Australian public that they should occupy the most important position in Canberra and in the nation. The parliamentarians generally didn't really have a problem with this, and they thought that it might be appropriate. I'm hypothetically surmising there. I don't really know what they thought, but in the end, they kept coming back as a parliament to Capitol Hill. So having legislated that Capitol Hill would become the site for the new Parliament House, the NCDC were putting together an exhibition regarding what the potentials of the new site could be. This occurred in 1977, which was 50 years after the construction of the provisional Parliament House, and the exhibition was to partly celebrate the 50-year anniversary. They commissioned a local architect in Canberra called Bert Reed to prepare a scheme, a hypothetical scheme, for what could occur on top of Capitol Hill if a Parliament House was to be located there. And this is the scheme that Bert Reed came up with. There's a couple of images here, but he also prepared plans and sections and put a lot of effort into resolving what the design might be. I don't know if he was intending to sort of try and capture the commission or not, but it was a lot of effort and resolution put into this particular scheme. Now, just things you might wish to note is that it's a building which has a cone shape, for want of a better word, follows the topography of the hill. There's a large forecourt and some angled walls which pick up the radial roads, directing the attention towards the centre of the hill. It also has a large flagpole right in the centre. And this is a typical image that you might have seen if you're looking from the other side of the lake. It's worthwhile remembering this image and this particular vantage point because it crops up during the course of the competition entries. But as you can see, it has a sloping side, sits above the Provisional Parliament House, and the flag is in a prominent position, marking the centre of the hill. It also graced the joint reports of the standing committees, which were in charge of the construction and the competition selection of the new and permanent Parliament House, both on the covers and all the covers of all subsequent reports, and internally within it there were also images indicating what Bert Reed had designed. This is worth commenting upon because these were freely available. The exhibition was a public exhibition, and many architects around Australia would have had the opportunity to see, and at the very least, what the NCDC were anticipating would be an appropriate form for Parliament on Capitol Hill. The competition, which was opened in 1979, was announced in 1978. And this is a part of an editorial from The Age, and I'll just read it for you for those who can't see it clearly at the rear. With some reluctance and apprehension, the federal government yesterday approved proposals for a new permanent Parliament House. We agree with the decision and hope that most Australians will resist the temptation to mock the project as a monument to self-interest, self-importance and extravagance. It didn't last very long before the mocking started. This is a cartoon by Moore in the Bulletin. And again, if you can't read the captions, it says, "We've decided to release $150 million to house the needy." Much jubilation by the public. And Malcolm is taking John Howard away, saying, "That's my boy." Now, if we could turn to the competition itself. As I said, it opened up in the early parts of 1979 and was open for a period of around 4 or 5 months. Now, To enter the competition and to make a submission, you had to comply with the competition requirements, which were for 10 large format boards. And you can see that I've got 9 of those here. They have to have site plans, circulation plans, plans at every level, sections and elevations, three-dimensional images, photographs of a model, and obviously a model needed to be made of a particular requirement to fit with the specifications of the master model that the competition organisers had. So it had to have all the topography and the roads in accordance with those specifications. And by my calculations, the cost to the architectural profession in Australia and internationally on today's value would have been about $15 million. So, in effect, the profession donated $15 million for the selection of the architect for Parliament House. There's a lot of work involved. There was always also a $50 deposit, which had to be put down before they were sent you the brief, and $50 in 1979 was more than it is now. And so the upshot was they weren't likely to attract any tyre kickers. Architects or those who were about to be architects who wanted to enter the competition were expected to be serious about it, were expected to do a lot of work, invest some own their own money before they even got a chance to start, and obviously invest a lot of money, time and effort in preparing the competition entry. And just as an aside, I've looked at all 328 of these entries, and very few of them, merely a handful, didn't complete the full 10 boards. The vast majority of the entrants took it very seriously, completed all the boards and all the information that was required, and resolved all their schemes to quite a high level. So the question in my mind then and now is, why would architects do it? Why would you enter this? What's the chance of entering thinking that you might possibly win? Because that's the only reason you would do it. You wouldn't go in it as an intellectual exercise. You wouldn't go in it because it's something you can knock over in a weekend. It took months of work, and so you would only go in it with the thought that you could win. And why would architects think that they could win? Because only one of them was going to win. This is partly the reason. The Sydney Opera House. This is the competition entry from Jørn Utzon, a Danish architect. He wasn't small, he was tall. But a Danish architect who ran a small architectural practice, had never been to the site, had done minimal entry requirements, a couple of images expressing a vision of what he thought might be appropriate for the Sydney Opera House on that particular site. And he won the competition. Now, for most architects, this is the great attraction, I suppose, of competitions. The belief that anybody could win it. Doesn't matter how small you are, doesn't matter what your intentions are. If you've got a vision and it's a good vision, then you have a chance of winning the competition. These were the judges for the Sydney Opera House. Leslie Martin, Cobden Parks, Eero Saarinen and Harry Ashworth. I put this slide in only to prove my other thesis that in the 1950s, 75% of all men wore glasses and smoked pipes. There's no other reason for having this here. If I move to the brief now, I'll start talking about the organisation of the competition. But just returning briefly to the Sydney Opera House and how it might have been an inspiration for architects to enter the competition in the first place and invest so much time and energy. It was equally an inspiration for the organisers to ensure that the Sydney Opera House never happened again. Not because they didn't like the building, but because it was difficult to build, if not impossible at the time, had huge cost overruns and huge time overruns, and caused a large amount of political damage. It did so partly because the brief for the competition wasn't specific enough and didn't exclude the type of visions that couldn't be achieved, and also because the competition jurors themselves enabled it to occur. The apocryphal story is that Eero Saarinen, who was an international architect of some repute, on the jury, he wasn't able to come to the judging process until it had already commenced, and he went to the reject pile, which the other three members have actually sorted some entries out, and pulled out the Utzon competition entry and said, this one's going to be winning. Now, I say it's apocryphal, but the truth of the matter is that he did go through the entries that weren't selected and did have some support for the Utsun scheme, which was obviously supported by the other members. So the implication was that whatever happened with the Parliament House of Australia, those circumstances should not be repeated. As I said, it wasn't an issue of the quality of the building. It was an issue of the political damage that could be caused. Also, Parliament House was running to a very strict timeline. Competition was in 1979. A winner would not be announced until 1980, and they had to have the building completed for an opening in 1988, the bicentenary. And that's a very short period of time for such a major undertaking. In fact, at the time, it was the largest building undertaking in Australia. So, how, with regard to what the buildings and the competition should look to in terms of symbolism, there were some rhetorical discussions within the brief. And again, I'll read these for the benefit of the people at the back who may not be able to see it. But this is a portion of the brief discussing the symbolism of what the building should be. Under historicism, they say, the competitors should question whether it is appropriate that a building of the late 20th century use the language of bygone eras. Fairly straightforward, they don't want a building which has historical references associated with it. Under monumentality, they ask the question, what would be the connotations in the mind of a visitor of a building with a monumental scale sited on a hill? Does significant mean bigness? Under abstract expression of the democratic process, should the functional aspects of the building be moulded into an abstraction of checks and balances? And they bracket Brasilia, which is a similar capital city built from scratch in Brazil. I won't bother talking about that much. Expression of growth. Does the nature of the requirements imply an acknowledgement of the forces of growth and change? And under symmetry, the requirements are not symmetrical. Symmetry cannot be obtained at the expense of functional efficiency. Now, in regard to these questions, like does significance mean bigness, if you're someone potentially entering this competition, would you answer yes? Or would you answer no? Why is the question in there in the first place? It is expected that the answer will be no. And under expression of growth, under symmetry, for instance, it's quite clear that you're not to, in some ways, apply symmetry, enforce symmetry on a building program which is an asymmetrical program in its sense. It's asymmetric because you have the Senate and the House of Representatives. They are different sizes and they have different support facilities in terms of amenities around them. So the program itself is leading towards an asymmetrical outcome. And so, if you're an entrant and you read these questions, you would have a fair idea, or should have a fair idea, of what the aims and ambitions of the competition are and the jurors. These are the jurors. From left to right, we have I.M. Pei. Oh, I might start at the beginning. That's Sir John Overall, who was the commissioner for the NCDC and became the head of the Parliamentary Construction Authority. He was in charge of the process. He spoke to John Andrews, who's an architect, an Australian architect working overseas who had an international reputation, and asked him if he'd like to be a juror, and John Andrews said, yes, I would. John Overall also asked him who he would recommend as another international architect who could join the jury. John Andrews recommended Romaldo Jurgala first and I.M. Pei. John Overall asked Aldo Jurgala whether he would like to be on the jury, and he said, no, I'd rather be an entrant. And ask I.M. Pei instead. So I.M. Pei is the other international architect. Both I.M. Pei and John Andrews, if you care for the categorisation, were modernists when it came to architectural language. We also had Professor Len Stevens, who was an engineer from the University of Melbourne, on the jury. His only role, well, one of his only roles, was to make sure whatever was would win the competition was buildable, and buildable within the time frame. He knew when the end product had to be completed by, and wanted it completed by then. The other two you may recognise are Senator Evans, who represented the Members of Parliament from the Senate, and Barry Simon, who was an MP from the House of Representatives. Now, what were the judges looking for, and how do we know what processes they went through? As I was going through the competition entries, a number of these things started cropping up on some of the entries, the spots of varying colours. And there was, it started to become a correlation between those spots and the projects that were selected for the 10 prizes at the end and for the 5 shortlisted entrants which were to go on to the second stage. And I asked John Andrews what the spots meant, and he said, oh, they had something to do with projects which we thought were, thought were worthy of consideration. And Len Stevens also said the same thing. Unfortunately, neither of them can remember the exact system of the spots and why one spot was blue and one was brown and what that might mean. But I have been able to correlate that most 4 out of the 5 second stage entrants had blue spots on them. One had a red spot on the drawings. Sorry, the other way around. Red spots on them. One had a blue spot on it, but a red spot on the program and the report that was associated with it. And the 10 entrants tended to have blue spots. I think there was one brown spot in there. That doesn't necessarily definitively mean anything other than marginal interest. So what I did was look at the spots. There are about 40 schemes that I could identify which had spots on them. And I say had spots on them because some spots had fallen off, but the mark of the spot had still been there. And a couple of spots had been crossed out. So I looked at the schemes which had the spots and said, well, what are they indicating in terms of trends that the judges are looking for in terms of the competition entries? And I'll go through a number of trends here which I've identified. One was a sort of what I call the topographical trend with a stepped building. This project here, generally they had something sort of central and monumental in the centre of the site, and then the building sort of stepped down the hill in various directions. I've called that a topographical one because it's not a building which ignores the fact that it's sitting on top of a hill or a scheme which would do so. Others were a form of constructed hill. This story, scheme by Peter Staunton is, again, a central point, and you can see it's tending to look like the hill has been reconstructed with like a cap placed over the topography of that particular hill. You might recognise some similarities between this one and the Burt Reed scheme you saw earlier in terms of sort of stepping the way up towards the hill top and then a peak at the beginning and a triangular forecourt in the middle with receiving those two roads that lead to the centre of the site. Then there's the underground project, which is actually a recreated hill. This scheme by Cheeseman and McKenna shows a large pole which is reportedly supposed to attract the sun's rays and create energy somehow, which would then provide enough electricity to sort of power Parliament House. Parliament House is under here, and there are a number of forecourts located here. By my reckoning, he's got it round the wrong way because this is the front forecourt, but here is the front of the site, and that leads down to Provisional Parliament House over here. What these forecourts show are tennis courts and bowling greens for the members of Parliament, but I'm not sure if that was easily recognised. But obviously, this was a spotted scheme and it had a blue spot, and so it was under consideration by the judging panel as being an appropriate or potentially appropriate response. There's another category which I call organic, where the building just sort of spread and grew as was necessary to accommodate the program. This is a rectangular geometry where the building sort of spread down and around the hill, and they would do so to accommodate what was occurring inside. And there was no regard in trying to force a symmetry on these particular buildings, but just let the uses internally dictate where the building would spread to. There is, again, an organic which uses a triangular and hexagonal geometry. Now, this geometry comes from the planning of Canberra itself, which is almost equilateral triangles in regard to its planning. Not exactly, but relatively closely. And so hexagons and triangles were a fairly common theme amongst the entries, and certainly they were common amongst the entries of the spotted schemes. As you can see here, using this geometry, again, just keep spreading as far as it needs go to accommodate all the brief and the requirements of Parliament House. Then another one which I call the organic grid infinite scheme, which doesn't seem to have any reason why it would stop. It is gridded all the way around and just will keep spreading as far as it would go and could expand as far as it needs to go. Presumably it could take over the world. The only features were these two little sort of fins here, like shark's fins, which I presume were indicating the House of Representatives and the Senate underneath. And then you would have a series of courtyards, light courts within it, to allow daylight to get through. As you can imagine, circular geometries were relatively popular as well in terms of organising and controlling the building and how it would sit on top of the hill. Again, similarly planned, they would have something centrally located which would have some sort of monumental characteristic about it, and then be circular or rings of building around those. Sometimes there'd be a courtyard in the centre, sometimes it would be filled out with various rings. And the circular geometry can also organise how the building was sort of spread out and stepping down the hill. And I said that, as noted, the circular geometry comes directly from the Griffin planning for Canberra. There's the horseshoe plans. Now, as we noted, that the apex of Capitol Hill was it could be designated as the most important location in Australia. And those who were a bit tentative about putting a building on that particular location did so by putting a building around it. And there are a number of horseshoe plans in the schemes, and we'll see another one later in the final prize winners. But as you can see, public forecourt in the centre and buildings wrapping around it. There's one version of it there, another version of it here, like a stadium with sort of tiered windows and floors looking down again to the public area in the centre. Asymmetrical schemes. You can remember the note in the brief about not forcing symmetry upon the program. Some architects took this a bit too literally and forced asymmetry upon the program. And these aren't the wildest of the schemes in terms of asymmetry, but you can see it wasn't an uncommon theme within the spotted schemes and within the general population of the competition entries themselves. And it was certainly fitting in with the time of architectural fashion when the idea of symmetry and monumentality through symmetry was not seen as an appropriate post-war solution. And there's one which I call programmatic asymmetry, which is essentially a symmetrical framework or a symmetrical approach to the planning, but the planning will then bulge out and expand in some areas to accommodate the unequal program between the Senate side and the House of Representatives side. And these two schemes here, you can see essentially a symmetrical approach with some asymmetry pushing out to one side, and similarly here, again, an essential symmetrical arrangement of forms, but they expand and out towards this side to accommodate the additional program required on that side. There are those that spanned the land axis, where they placed buildings across, perpendicular to the land axis. Now, this would seem, as I said, there's a number of versions of this scheme, but many of the schemes, and certainly the ones in the spotted schemes, try to ameliorate the fact that they were blocking the land axis by having some way of dealing with it, either continuing through or being accommodated. And in these two cases, the building that spans the axis is actually a hurdle rather than a fence or a barrier, where you have a building sort of going over the top of the axis with some other buildings under here and similarly here. So notionally, the axis goes underneath and keeps going, potentially. There were a couple which had spots crossed out. And looking at the biro marks that spot across them out, they were fair indentations on the boards. I don't know for what reason they were crossed out, although I could speculate, but I won't speculate here. This is a scheme by a South African firm of architects, Brits and Scholes, which is essentially a wall scheme where there's a barrier or wall around which, within which is the functions of Parliament, and you enter through the front gate. This scheme by Lydia, I'm not exactly sure what's going on here, except there's a land bridge, there's a building, there's the centre of the site, and it seems to be no way of getting from here to here. But for whatever reason, that was at one stage may have been considered, but at another stage was taken out of the loop. But if we look at the walled scheme, there are a number of projects, themes that didn't make the spots. the spotted groups. And the walled theme was one of those, the idea that you have sort of a walled enclosure within which Parliament sits, a bit like a castle or a fortress or a walled city. Here's a scheme by Canadian architect Acheson, which was based on Carcassonne, the walled city, which was a series of walls and buttressing and some sort of ramparts and things. I suppose you could fire weapons from here if you wish to do so. And then something quite wild and fantastic occurring inside. That didn't make the spotted groups. And that theme didn't make the spotted groups. Other things that didn't make the spotted groups, large monumental gestures. This project by Robin Gibson is a single form. Now, the idea of a single form on the hill might work at a distance, but certainly wouldn't work as well when you get close to it, because the singularity of it doesn't reduce as you approach the site. And schemes similar to this were also not included amongst the spotted gang. Large expressive sculptural gestures, such as this one by Goldberg from Western Australia, which was a sort of rising up of forces somehow or other to perform like a sculptural element at the end of the land axis centrally on the Capitol Hill. There are a few of these, not as many as I was expecting, to be perfectly honest, with sculptural solutions. But as I noted, there were no sculptural solutions included in this particular instance in the spotted groupings of projects. A category I call megastructures, just very large structural things at a very large scale occurring on, across, or above the site. This one also didn't make it. And there were a number of these because technologies at the time of the late 1970s were in vogue as far as architectural expression was concerned, and the idea that you can have large structural occurrences incorporated in your expression was a fairly popular theme, but it didn't extend to the popularity with the spots. Relaxed geometry or informality didn't make it also. And there were, again, a large number of these schemes in the broader population where there is no real control over the geometry and where the buildings are located and how they are organised on the site, or an appearance that there's no control, I should say. And these schemes also were seen perhaps to be too informal, that whatever occurred on the site for a new Parliament House, we didn't want monumental formality, but we also didn't want relaxed informality as well. Again, that's my supposition. And the other ones, there was a number of schemes which had oval geometries. When you're sitting on the middle of a circle with triangular geometries to get you there, having an oval would seem to be a bit challenging with regard to the geometry. And so none of the oval-based schemes made their way to the spotted schemes. This scheme by Korzenuski, which I have quite a liking for, picked up on sort of the grand piazza of Bernina into the forecourt of St. Peter's in Rome. And so also it may have not become under consideration because it did have historical references also associated with it. And I don't know why this scheme didn't make it. I put it under the category of Russian spaceship coffee pot scheme. I don't need to say any more about that. Temple forms. Again, there was a number of temple forms and they also didn't make it. The idea of the imagery of a temple on top of the hill may not have been an appropriate one, but also is a confusing image in regard to the National Library, which also has a similar type of form to it. Now, I'll move on to the 10 winners. There were 10 entries which were considered winners and they received a monetary prize. Of those 10 winners, there were 5 who were invited to go into the second stage, and they were given some more money to complete their second stage. So I'll talk about the 10 winners and the 5 that didn't make the second stage and then talk about the second stage. This is Daryl Jackson's entry. And if we're again looking for the trends that we've seen in the, emerging from the spotted entries, it's an organic nature in terms of it can expand through its geometries wherever the forces of the program would like it to go, and growth can be accommodated. It picks up on a triangular hexagonal geometry, as was common amongst a large number of the schemes. This is one that spanned the land axis. But unlike their previous ones, examples I showed in the spotted schemes, which had like a hurdle under which the land axis could continue through, this one stops the land axis with a building, but ameliorates it by having sort of a ski jump effect at the end, which might allow the impression that it can just sort of scoot over the top and keep going. But it obviously impressed the judges to the extent that it was one of the 10 winners. A symmetrical scheme, but one which has a stepping down, a topographical stepping down, which follows the landforms of Capitol Hill. Again, another one spanning the axis. A relatively modest building in many ways in terms of its expression, and it accommodates the fact that it ends the land axis by being curved on the facade, which would allow the axis, I suppose, to sort of spread around the building, perhaps, and then continue on behind. It also is asymmetrical, even though it has a symmetrical entry, where one half of the building is longer than the other half to accommodate the differences in the two programs. And this is Harry Seidler's scheme, which is an asymmetrical one based on program, where the thrust of the building is symmetrical, as we can see through here, with the organisation of the main features here, but the support features for the two Houses of Parliament around here are asymmetrical and potentially could grow and extend as the requirements would determine. Now, of the five who were invited to go into the second stage, one of the schemes was Denton Corker Marshall's. I'm only going to show their initial entries here. I won't show their second stage entries to any degree, because I think what I'm interested in is why they were selected into the second stage in the first place. This is one which is ostensibly a symmetrical scheme. It is based on a grid pattern. Now, the grid pattern itself implies that there can be some expansion and some growth following the Cartesian geometry, which is sort of laid over the top of the hill. It also broke down the form of the building by stepping and also a series of open grids through the top and through the sides, which would allow light and views and sight lines through the building. So even though it was a symmetrical building, it wasn't what I would consider to be a monumental building. A scheme by Bickerdike, a British architect. This is an unusual one in terms of in regard to the quality of the submission. This is typical of the quality of the submission in terms of sketches on yellow trace paper, not particularly well resolved or well rendered. And it was interesting when I asked both John Andrews and Len Stevens, who were judges, why this one made it into the last five. All they could say, without getting too particular, was that one of the judges had a particular liking for it, and we held on to it until it got into this particular stage. As we'll see at the end, it didn't end well. Another one was the scheme by Parsons and Waite, which is a horseshoe entry, typical of the theme that we saw before. This is the renowned red dot, which seems to have some correlation about how far they went in the competition. And the other scheme was the scheme by Colin Madigan, a Sydney-based firm, which was an asymmetrical arrangement of parts, not particularly following the geometry of Griffin, but having its own sort of internalised geometry coordinating it. Again, there were some comments by some of the jurors I interviewed regarding this scheme, which caused me to wonder why it had also made the last five. So those four, these are the second stage projects and the way they completed them. If you remember the Bickerdike scheme, it looks nothing like that one in the second stage as it did compared to the first stage. It came back as a completely new design. It didn't do their project and their chances any services or favours by doing that, unfortunately. And this is the DCM scheme, Parsons and Waite, and the Colin Madigan scheme. Colin Madigan was the architect for the National Gallery and for the High Court in the Parliamentary Triangle. Now, if we move to the winner, the Mitchell-Jurgler-Thorpe scheme. The assessors, in concluding why they thought this was a winning scheme, called it a design that is at once natural and monumental. seems to be a bit of a schism or a, between those two particular characteristics. But they explain that by saying that it took on the form of the hill, it appreciated the topography of Canberra, it appreciated the monumental structure of Canberra's planning from the initial Griffin's scheme, and found a way to consolidate and organise all of those features within a single gesture, or a number of single gestures. As you can see, and you probably know it very well, so I won't bother describing it in any great detail, but the land axis through here, the two wings, walls, and then either side you have this, I think the Senate's this side? No, I get that wrong. Always get that wrong. The Senate's on this side, House of Reps over here. And so those functions of government are here. What's worth noting about this scheme, as distinct from their second stage entry, was that they accommodated asymmetry of the program either side of these wing walls. And so one side can grow differently and at a different rate and be a different size and scale compared to the other size, because it's all contained within that single gesture of the two walls. That's the initial stage one model which they submitted. And again, you can see there is a difference between the arrangement of buildings on one side to the other. Not a great difference, but at least an acceptance of the fact that one of the requirements in the brief was to deal with an asymmetrical program. And so they indicated how that could be done. And this is a stage two model. You'll notice here that the asymmetry has largely disappeared. There are some minor asymmetrical factors, but not much to any, or not sufficient to cause any expression other than a symmetrical expression. Now, I just want to quote some of the assessor's reports. I have some other slides which talk about where the Dougal scheme may have come from in terms of the design, but I don't wish to go into those at this particular stage because I'm running tight on time, so I'll just quickly nip through those. Well, I might just show one slide. This is Bert Reed's scheme up here. This is the Griffin's initial entry scheme, and this is the Mitchell-Jugler-Thought scheme through here. And the contention I was making with this slide that there is some comparisons that can be made between these three, ignoring this one for the moment, which indicate that what would be an appropriate gesture architecturally on top of Capitol Hill was not something that occurred completely out of the blue, that it was built up over a large period of time. And probably you could argue that it was built up from the very first gesture that the Griffins put on top of it. That's the happy winners, Rick Thorpe, Romaldo Jugler, and I think William Mitchell. Now, I'll read this because, again, I understand you can't read it very well. This is from the Parliament House Design Competition, a report by the Construction Authority on the winning design. And it says, like Griffin's plan, the winning design is a building of firm, clear geometry, not rigidly imposed on the terrain, but sensitively adjusted to it. The design is not a monumental structure superimposed on the hill. It derives its strong presence by merging built form with the land form. The successful synthesis of these two essential elements has resulted in a design that is at once natural and monumental. That's how they're trying to put those two competing, which you would think were competing characteristics, together. So why did the Mitchell-Jugler-Thorpe scheme win? Well, it respected the Griffin legacy and responded to it in an almost self-effacing manner. It exuded modesty with its low-rise expression while marking the site with a ghost-like flag, which had allusions to Griffin's initial Capitol building, or certainly the ziggureted roof of it. It worked with symmetry without demanding monumentality and allowed for growth without being asymmetrical. And it had a geographical scale from a distance, but a domestic scale when you enter the building. And the last one, which I think is most importantly, that politically it would not scare the horses. Again, I just want to read from the assessor's report. Um, The Competition Assessor's report on the winning scheme claimed, and I'll quote here, an overpowering building presence would be, and their quotation at the end, undemocratic. Instead, the expression of the MGT scheme will be accessible for all, even children who will, and I quote, will clamber and play all over its roof, close quote. Presumably, these same children will, quote again, will not only be able to climb on the building, but draw it easily too. The lack of pretensions of the scheme would allow its simple imagery to become part of the nation's lexicon of kitsch icons. And I'll quote them again, the obvious boomerang analogy of the curvilinear walls may in time become as internationally representative of Australia as the kangaroo. Now, the entreaty for public acceptance of the design within the conceptual reach of the general public points to the relief felt from the controlling authorities that the winning scheme avoided ostentation and aloofness, and that this may dampen the inevitable public criticism of committing the public purse to one of the largest projects in Australia's history. The resultant recreated hill is a political solution of the most exquisite order, the political parameters for which were firmly in place well before the competition was even envisaged. Tracing the political management and concoction of the competition processes and brief, it is hard to imagine a viable alternative to this winning entry. And if I'm allowed to return to the initial analogy of this lecture, if the political context of Parliament House was a challenge, and as a challenge it was a square hole, then the Mitchell-Jurgler-Thorpe peg was a perfect fit. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Fascinating material, absolutely fascinating. If you have a question, would you like to go to the microphone? And it must be a question.
Before I ask my question, there's a preliminary. We have a picture of what country up in front of us? That's my preliminary.
I've understood
that architecture is symbolism. But because I've just been trapped into saying I'm not to give a background, but I have to have a question, I'll leave that as the question. Will you tell me what this architecture that's been foisted on us is supposed to symbolise?
Well, I talked briefly about the symbolic expectations of the competition organisers. And what we have in this particular building of Parliament House is a symbolism which is avoiding, or supposed to be avoiding, monumentality and supposed to be avoiding ostentation. And if I'll quote a comment that was being made in previous decades, that this building is not meant to look like a palace of politicians. It is meant to look like a working house of Parliament and to house the politicians to achieve that. Whether it does or not is open to interpretation of any individual, but I know and can perceive that from the competition itself that that was what was driving much of their consideration.
Next question.
Thank you for a fascinating lecture. Two very quick questions. As one of probably the only a handful of people in the world who've actually seen all the designs, do you think the right design won? And secondly, since this building is based on a 30-year design, do you think it's dated since?
I knew someone would ask me whether I thought this was the right decision or not. I think everyone has their own opinions about architecture and art and fashion, and I think anyone will look at all those schemes and find something that they would prefer as a potential solution. I don't doubt that for a second. But do I think this was probably one of the few solutions that could have won? I think it's one of the few that could have won, and probably the only one that could have won, given the way the competition was organised, the framework of the sensitivities around it. There were very few which were able to deal with that in such a proficient manner and controlled manner. Did I think it was the right one? Probably. But did I think it was the only one that could win the competition? Almost definitely. Now, with regard to fashion, buildings are buildings when they are built. And even though fashions change, whether they go in or out of fashion, I don't think is relevant. I think they are statements from when they are built, and in 100 years' time, they'll still be statements of when they were built, and I think that's what they should be aiming to be. The idea that architecture can be timeless is an old-fashioned idea. That's a joke, by the way.
I will sort of say something preliminary to make sense of my question. I worked in this building for 10 years and 4 years at the old house. I think it's a wonderful place in all its aspects. However, I notice that tourism authorities tend to try to play down the Parliament House and talk about attracting people to Canberra, the vineyards, the the sporting facilities, the War Memorial, et cetera, don't mention Parliament House sort of thing. What can be done to sort of awake a desire to appreciate this as a great gift to the nation rather than play it down and ignore it?
I don't know that I can answer that question about how you might make it more attractive, because it should, for anyone coming to Canberra, be one of the most attractive features here. And I'd be surprised if anyone coming to Canberra didn't make an effort as a tourist to come to Parliament House, because symbolically it is the centre, but also it creates an air of interest about the political situations contained within it. And you never know, if you come to Parliament House, some of those political situations might spill out onto the foyer or into the forecourt. We never know what might happen. So I think there's that air of there's politicians in here doing things which we read about in the papers. I think that's a very attractive feature of Parliament House. And I don't know what else you could do to make it more attractive.
Ironically, it may also be something unattractive about the building.
I didn't mean beautiful, I just meant attractive.
That's an entree into my question, was it? I wanted to ask, I work in the Parliament House as well, two questions. The first was around the land access and this Parliament House. Now, I think we're on it. I think we're on the access, or at least I am. but my understanding now is that it's essentially sort of see-through. If one, there's even a very, very narrow window down at the back of the Prime Minister's courtyard, and one, it's a long, skinny sort of pencil-like window, and you can sort of look all the way through, in theory. And I always wonder, what are you looking through to? What's behind here, and why was that access sort of thought to be have to, in a sense, cut Parliament House in half? The second question I wanted to ask was about the levels. My understanding was that Malcolm Fraser had a theory that, because the Prime Minister and all of the ministers, a large number of the ministers and everything takes place on the ground floor, and then the people come up on the second floor and sort of look down. I understand that element, but my understanding was that that was largely driven by Malcolm Fraser's security concerns, and I wondered if that was true or not, and if so, whether that was a form that was well executed.
Yeah, just on the land access, to actually see through the building, you'd have to go through the Great Hall, I think through the Prime Ministerial Executive, and then to see your slit window at the back there. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it stops at the forecourt. I don't know what else we could do about that.
If all the doors are open, you actually can see through.
You can, yes, yeah, but I don't think it happens very often, if at all. The other issue was of what's a land access supposed to be looking through to. The Griffins intended that it would lead to Capitol Hill, but in their early schemes, and I just put up this image here hoping it would be behind, but in their early schemes which have this view across the lake, there is another mountain behind, again, which actually doesn't exist. And it looks a bit like Mount Fuji in the early renderings. You've probably seen it. And I think there was some indication that that would line up with that as well. Going through it, but I think the competition by the Griffins was done without them visiting the site. It was based on sort of topographical mappings, so I think once they visited the site, it was determined that obviously the land axis would lead to, logically, Capitol Hill. So in that respect, it's not intended that it flows through exactly, although that possibility is there. No. That's right, yes. It doesn't have any prominence, what they thought it might have. With regard to the idea that you can sort of see through the Parliament, I think that's also a symbolic idea. And that should be joined up with a symbolic idea that you could walk over the roof of Parliament, which you can almost do now. initially the idea that you could roll over it, and as I said, the assessor's saying that children would play on it. That's a very... it's a sort of supposed democratic characteristic which was taken up by the assessors and the commentators of the final scheme to say this is a building which is open. It's a democratic building. It's not owned by the politicians. It's owned by the people of Australia. And the fact that you can walk over the top of it, and in some cases, although minimal, you can actually see through it, was a very important aspect which they were trying to promote as a way of, again, alleviating the idea that it was an exclusionary space, rather it was an inclusive space. I can't. There was some changing of the brief between the competition entry and the final outcome, and there was some things done regarding the Prime Ministerial Executive and spaces which may have impacted upon that idea. Yeah.
Scott, do you have a question? One last quick question.
I've worked in the House and I love it, but I've just had a longish holiday in Sydney. And as I explored the centre of town, I was reminded of a question that is nothing to do with the architecture, but the question that I found myself wondering yet again is it in the wrong place? Was it a year or so? Fairly recently, Bob Brown made the point that if you're coming over Commonwealth Avenue Bridge, it's very difficult to get here, whereas if you look at other parliaments around Australia, let alone around the world, they're in the city. You can really just go walking along Macquarie Street and there's Parliament House. It's easy to find down near Salamanca markets in Hobart. And I sometimes have wondered whether or not it isn't as accessible to people because they can't walk to it easily.
That's a point that was made in the early 1920s. When there was some mooting about changing the site from Camp Hill to Capitol Hill, that we couldn't expect the population of Australia to trudge up the hill, as it was called, to visit parliamentarians. So it's not a recent revelation. It's sort of something which has been at the minds of the planners for a long time. And it's something to do with the reluctance, I think, to sort of finally bed down where the site for Parliament House would be. Whether they made the right decision, again, is a personal interpretation.
Okay, well, our time is up, unfortunately. Don't forget open day tomorrow, but for now, please join me in thanking Andrew Hutson for a fantastic lecture.